This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. There is a big difference between an organic label and a non-GMO label, but many people seem to confuse the two. We'll talk with a researcher who found that consumers use the two interchangeably, but they're anything but that. We'll also talk with another researcher who found that the color of packaging on food can dictate its attractiveness to consumers, even when the same thing's in the package. A tale of two food marketing studies is in the second half of our show. But first, a study recently came across our desk that definitely caught our eye. Researchers have documented instances of alligators venturing beyond their inland freshwater habitats to coastal waters where they prey upon sharks. Yes, you heard me right. Shark-eating gators. This is not a Halloween trick. There has been anecdotal evidence of this behavior dating back to the 1800s, but now there is actual data to back it up. We're joined now by the lead researcher on this study to discuss how it was conducted and what it means. Dr. James Nifong is a postdoctoral research associate at Kansas State University. Dr. Nifong, welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, we'd love to have you join the conversation, too. Have you ever seen a gator in coastal or estuarine waters? Have you ever seen one tangle with a shark or a ray? Give us a call and tell us your story at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Dr. Nifong, you're there in the middle of the country in Kansas. I want to know, what got you interested in studying alligators and their eating habits?
So I actually did my undergraduate studies as well as my graduate work and a postdoc position at the University of Florida. So that was when most of this study was conducted. And I've now moved on to another position with Kansas State University. So historically, my dissertation research focused on the use of marine habitats by alligators and sort of the factors that contribute to variation in it, and just variation across their range in that behavior.
So how long have you been looking into this?
So I started my research back in 2007, about 10 years.
Oh, so that's quite a while to be looking into it.
Yeah, and this was just a small sort of a piece of the entire puzzle. And as I was conducting my dissertation research, I've often interact with people that work out in these environments and sort of asking around, has anybody seen, alligators and sharks interacting? And, over that sort of 10-year time frame, I was able to collect, photographs and accounts from individuals that, saw this occurring.
So have we been wrong to assume all this time that alligators aren't really interested in saltwater prey?
Yeah, so they actually very readily travel to saltwater habitats, mainly in estuaries and near shore, like salt marshes. And, they're not very often going out into the, 60, 80 foot deep, open waters. But they do this since they don't have any salt glands to deal with the excess salt that they build up while they're out there. They just go back and forth from freshwater to saltwater. And they'll stay about 5 to 7 days out in saltwater, then come back to the freshwater about, similar amount of time, 6, 7 days, and just repeat that process.
So they kind of go into like a salt detox sort of, go into the freshwater and then head back out. So this isn't really an entirely new concept. Apparently there's some anecdotal stories about coastal gators dating back to the 1870s.
Yeah, so historically it seems that this behavior was maybe more common. That could be because, first there's less development of the coastline, and there were a lot more alligators back then. They reached endangered status in the early 1900s, and so since that time they've been rebounding. But so there are some historical newspaper clippings that we found that describe large clashes between sharks and alligators, and mortality going in both directions. So alligators eating sharks as well as sharks eating alligators.
So it goes both ways, huh?
Yeah. And it's really a size dynamic. What we would see is, if a very large shark sort of came across a smaller alligator, well, then, you can see where that's going to go, and vice versa. So if you have a very large alligator and a smaller shark, well, then that's on the menu for today.
Wow. So you looked back into the old newspaper clippings and you found old reports of this. I guess people would see that. And then you decided that you wanted to prove once and for all that this does happen. How did you go about doing that?
Well, first, so there was one record published back in 1993 of an alligator eating, or a number of alligators having spines from stingrays in their jaws, you know, when they're captured. And so that information was out there. So we knew it at least it happened with one stingray species. And then I started talking to some researchers out in the field, actually a sea turtle researcher who was on the beaches in coastal Georgia pretty much every night, you know, in the entire summer for, you know, a number of years. So he, you know, provided some, you know, observations that he had made of alligators eating sharks in the surf zone. And then I sort of sent out a request for information to professionals, and that got back a couple observations and photos. And as well, I started working with my co-author, Russ Lowers, down at Kennedy Space Center. He's a wildlife biologist for them. And he routinely finds alligators consuming stingrays there, and probably other juvenile shark species as well, but they haven't looked at the stomach contents and sort of figured it out yet. So most of these, you know, or actually all these, were direct observations of the feeding event happening. So we didn't find any, even though I've stomach pumped 500 alligators or more in coastal habitats, I have found no evidence of it.
So really?
So you went out, you know, a conundrum.
So you went out there. How do you stomach pump an alligator? Not that I really want any graphic details. I mean, it is Halloween and everything, but do you stun them? Do they have to be deceased in order to stomach pump them? Or?
So they are ectothermic, or they rely on their environment for body heat to produce their heat and maintain their internal temperature. So in coming with that, they're very susceptible to tranquilizers and things. They basically will not wake back up if you do something like that. So so all the alligators are live and alert when we're doing this. And you get them into the boat, various capture techniques, such as a snag hook or a snare that you get and bring them over to the boat. And then you tape their mouth shut and you get them on the boat. Do a couple measurements and things and tissue collections that we do with our research. And then when it comes time to start stomach pumping, you strap them down to it's called a spine board you'd see in an ambulance. And then you kind of tilt them at an angle and untape their mouth again, and you stick either a PVC or steel section of pipe in their mouth, and that keeps them from shutting their mouth. And you tape that around, you tape around their mouth, and you tape that pipe section in their mouth, and then you're kind of free to insert a tube and run some water in it and basically fill up the stomach. And it's almost like a Heimlich maneuver where you would push, and once that stomach is full with water and everything that was in the stomach plus the water, you know, comes out the front end. And you collect that up and then, you know, spend many hours looking through it under a microscope and whatnot.
So I'm just imagining this and kind of picturing, how do the alligators behave during this? Are they kind of resistant? I can't imagine they love it.
You know, every alligator is different. They do have personalities. Some don't like it at all. Some just are kind of ambivalent. They're just like, whatever, you know, as long as you're gonna let me go, then I don't care. And they do tire out fairly quickly. So, you know, once you captured them, you brought them to the boat, you got them up on the boat, you've done a couple things, you know, they're tired. So, you know, but the larger individuals, you know, they can be a little problematic. I mean, you know, I've had them crush the pipe that I, you know, was sticking in there.
That's what I'm thinking. I mean, I've heard, you know, legendary tales of their fabulous jaw strength when they're biting down.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't believe they wouldn't bite it and crush it.
Yeah, for large individuals, I mean, we're using, you know, almost a half-inch thick steel pipe.
Yeah.
So there's no way, they're going to crush that.
And those might be the ones...
And the way it sits in the mouth is kind of like an arc, so it, you know, it's not a very good biting angle for them either.
Yeah, but it's just imagining this, and I think you would need to get those big guys though, because those would be the ones that'd be more likely to be able to take down a shark.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and it is difficult with them. You catch less of the larger ones, of course, just because it's, you know, a little easier to catch, you know, 10 foot and less.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, once they get about 10, 12 feet, you know, then they can also be pretty problematic in the fact that they don't want to give up what they just ate.
Yeah.
So they're so big and strong that they can actually just refuse to let you put the tube down in their stomach or refuse to, you know, puke anything up.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's tough. Yeah.
Do they not have a gag reflex?
No. Not that I've seen.
All right. It's kind of like a reverse foie gras situation here.
Yeah, and the main thing is they have a big cartilaginous flap on the back of their tongue, and they push that up when they're eating or when they're opening their mouth underwater, and that basically does not allow any water to pass by the back of their throat or pass through, you know, down the esophagus, so they can sit there and not be gurgling water. But so what you have to do is actually you have to hold that flap down as everything is coming out.
Wow.
So usually it's my hand that's in there. But.
And you haven't lost any fingers or anything yet?
Not yet, no.
Right.
Knock on wood.
So we have a call online. This is kind of an interesting story coming in from Mark in North Fort Myers. Mark, tell us your story.
Okay, I'll keep this as short as I can. Back in the 1980s, I was the horticulturist at the Edison Estate. And often I would get there early in the morning and just walk out on that long pier into the Caloosahatchee to see whatever was swimming around, because there were often game fish and interesting things. Well, one day I walked out, and for the first time in my life, I was watching, oh, it was young, probably only 2 feet long. I was watching a small-toothed sawfish.
Mm-hmm.
And as I was watching it slowly swimming around under the water, and it was only maybe 2 feet of water at the most, I saw a dark thing coming toward the sawfish, and it was a young gator, probably only 3 feet long, and it attacked and killed the sawfish and just took it out in deeper water right before my eyes.
Wow, what a story.
That's amazing. With sawfish are highly endangered. So that was,
yes, I realize that now. I didn't realize it at the time.
Yeah, and I don't know.
But I just thought it was an unusual behavior that maybe no one had ever seen before. And
yeah,
I just thought I'd mention it.
Yeah, thanks so much for this story. That's really an awesome one. That's really incredible. Thanks for sharing that.
You're very welcome.
Yeah, that's, I mean, very few people even see a sawtooth fish at all.
Yeah, yeah.
Much less that kind of interaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really cool. That was one of the questions we had, because over in Australia, they have another sawfish that goes up in fresh water, and they get hammered and harassed by freshwater crocodiles, as well as most likely estuarine crocodiles over there. They're endangered as well. So, that's what I really wanted to shed light on, some of these interactions. But they could be important for, you know, juvenile life stages of sharks, and especially when they're endangered.
Exactly. And I have friends that refer to Florida as like a lesser Australia anyway. So it seems like it's coming true. We're talking about new research showing how alligators sometimes venture into coastal saltwater environments to forage, sometimes eating sharks and rays. We're joined by researcher Dr. James Nifong from Kansas State University. You can join our conversation by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Or you can add your 2 cents on Facebook or Twitter. So you mentioned a little bit earlier, Dr. Nifong, that the there were more instances of this reported further back in history because of less development along the coastline. How is development impacting? I mean, you said that now also we're having a resurgence in alligators now that they're no longer endangered. And when you walk around my neighborhood, it seems like they're doing pretty good. But how does development impact this? And would that force them to stay away from the coast or go into it more?
So what we found, some other research that we're doing using just population surveys, is that in protected areas, coastal habitat, such as a wildlife refuge or a marine protected area, you see a higher abundances of alligators using that marine habitat. So that kind of tells you that, you know, in these other areas where there are no protections and people can develop, up to right to the coastline, and you often have seawalls and, big lights and lots of boats traffic and things like that, that, you know, alligators don't, they're kind of shy. They don't really like that, you know, a lot of stuff going on, you know, around them. So, so that's what we've seen, just some sort of anecdotal evidence of that. And as well, you know, they can also just totally cut off, you know, connections between saltwater and freshwater systems, development can, such as roads and, you know, putting coverts and things like that. And it really makes it hard for alligators to, you know, go from a freshwater wetland or pond out into marine habitat when they got to cross all this development and all this sprawl. You know, it's not to say that they don't do it. It's just that it makes it more difficult for them.
It's a little bit harder for them to do. So you pumped the stomach. How many alligators did you pump the stomachs of?
Probably a little over 500. I have to look at the exact numbers. And that was for my dissertation work and some publications after my dissertation.
So what do they typically eat then?
So in saltwater environments, they're mainly eating crustaceans, such as blue crabs, other crab species, shrimp, small fish, you know, and then to a lesser extent, they're eating things like wading birds and mammals that are out there, such as mink and otter and things like that. And then, you know, occasionally they get a shark, and we've published other data, evidence that they eat sea turtles as well. So, it's kind of a very broad diet, but they're typically eating smaller prey items such as crustaceans and small fish, and that's sort of what they're sustaining off of. And then every once in a while, they'll get really lucky.
Yeah, so like if they get a...
They'll get a big prey item.
Yeah, so they get something like a shark, that's like their Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah.
And they're pretty excited.
Yeah, they're good to like Christmas, yeah. Maybe a month or so, but yeah.
I just can't believe you went out there and did that. How does this play when you tell people what your dissertation was about when you're in Kansas?
And that's the funny thing. So I'm living in Mississippi, actually. My wife works for USDA office here in Oxford, Mississippi. So, but I do go out to Kansas for my job, you know, occasionally. And, they're always blown away. You know, I've given a couple of seminars at Kansas State University and, you know, talked about my research. And, you know, it's so foreign to them, you know, being landlocked and sort of way up, you know, in the middle of the country there. So they're very interested in hearing about it. I've got a lot of good feedback on it.
Yeah, they're studying catfish really pretty much up in there. I'm from the area, so I know this.
My advisor actually did study catfish.
I know, yeah. So where would people expect to find crocodiles? And I'm kind of nervous about going to the beach now. So, I mean, is this something that people would be looking at in, you know, in bays or up into the Caloosahatchee area? I mean, Caloosahatchee obviously is freshwater, but like those tributaries, is that where you're going to be finding these, not crocodiles, alligators?
Yeah, so you'll mainly see them in sort of the estuarine zone, the mixing zone of fresh and salt water. Or more near shore habitats like salt marsh creeks, you know, or mangrove swamp forests, and usually where the salinities are not full strength seawater, you know, they're, you know, anywhere from like half to full strength, but they hold a lot of prey items. These areas do; they're very productive systems, so that's where you'll see them at. Now, you know, the West Coast or the East Coast of Florida, they actually had a video of one that was 60 feet down on a patch reef. You know, a diving naturalist went down, and he thought somebody was playing a joke on him. There's an alligator sitting on a nice, beautiful, you know, white sand floor.
Really?
And it just kind of looked at him and swam away. And so they'll get out into these habitats. It's usually not as frequent. You'll get further out. It's just more frequent that they'll be very near shore and sort of in those, you know, tidal creek areas and mangroves.
So they can get back and do their salt detox. I'm curious, do you feel like we know a lot about alligators? I mean, if we can be surprised by them being 60 feet down, I mean, how much more is there to learn about what they're doing?
I think there's a lot to learn. You know, we've been... Me and colleagues of mine have been, you know, learning new things all the time. You know, we looked at, you know, with the stomach content stuff, we find out that they're actually not that much of a generalist predator in certain areas, and that they actually are very specialized on certain prey types, depending on their habitat. And so before, they were just thought to be kind of indiscriminate, killers that just eat anything that come in front of them. Well, you look at the data a little more, and that's actually not the case. So, there's all kinds of little things like that that really, catch my attention, and I think there's more to learn.
There might be a little pickier than we thought. So do crocodiles fit into this equation at all anywhere?
This is happening with crocodiles all over the world. Crocodiles eating sharks and sharks eating crocodiles. I go over in my paper, there's evidence from Australia, from Indonesia, from Africa, from South America, of these exact interactions, occurring. So, and there are some researchers actually working on it right now. At least over, I know some folks in India and Australia. So, there's 25 species of crocodilians across the world. American alligators, just one of them. Some of these crocodiles get very large, like your Australian saltwater crocodile. You get to 26 feet. So they can, are probably better predators on some even larger sharks, than what we're seeing with alligators.
Yeah, we're freaked out about our sharks because we are the lesser Australia again. So
right.
are you still studying them? You're down there in Mississippi?
Say that again.
Are you still studying them? You're in Mississippi, you said, or did you say Louisiana?
Last 10 years, I've collected a lot of data. So I'm continually publishing and figuring things out from the data that I've already collected. I do have a couple sort of active projects, but nothing in Mississippi yet.
Okay. Is there anything that you want to share with us that you're working on next? We don't want to tip your cards for anybody.
Yeah, we'll save that for the next round of publications that come out.
All right, so next show we'll be hearing about what you're working on now.
Sounds good.
That's all the time we have for this part of the show, but I want to thank my guest, Dr. James Nifong. He's a postdoctoral research associate at Kansas State University. Dr. Nifong, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And happy Halloween.
Thanks, you too.
Coming up, when shopping for food, the packaging can make all the difference. We'll talk with two professors with the University of Florida's Institute of Food and Agricultural Studies about color and buzzwords that have meaning.